Welcome to This Is Money podcast, brought to you in partnership with Charles Stanley Direct, the award-winning investment platform trusted by over 40,000 clients. Investment involves risk. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is Assistant Editor Lee Boyce. And we're asking, do you know how your pension works and what it's invested in? Of course you do, you're This Is Money readers, but a worrying proportion of the population have absolutely no idea. But does it matter? Talking of pensions, as Boris and Rishi are at odds over the future of the triple lock, we look at what the government's alternatives could be. Plus, is your child sitting on a 50 grand windfall? Is a private jet just for the rich and famous? And alcoholic water. What the heck is the point? Don't say we don't cover it all on this pod. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, as a reported rift breaks out at the top of government over the state pension triple lock, new research has exposed just how in the dark we are when it comes to our retirement savings. According to Hargreaves Lansdown, just a fifth of women are aware that their pension savings are invested in the stock market. When asked what people thought happened to their cash, for those people that didn't know it was invested, the most common answer was they had no idea. That was followed by a belief that it may be invested after all. While many thought the government was looking after their cash, gulp. Lee, it's not pretty reading, and I'm confident I know the answer to this, but why does it matter that we don't know how pensions work, where they're invested in, and particularly I mentioned there about the gender divide, a fifth of women. What is this research telling us?
Well, Georgie, it's vastly important that you take an active interest, in my opinion, in your pension. You know, this is going to be the sum of money that takes you into retirement, and you're going to want as much money as you can possibly muster up over your working career, saved in a great way of saving tax-free with pensions tax relief, and have that pot of cash to then draw the money from for your retirement life. And however long your retirement might be will depend on what you do when you're younger. And what's happening is, what this research is showing is that basically 7 in 10 people have got absolutely no idea how their pension works. And I'm going to be honest with you, Georgie, I can totally understand why. I think people hear the word pensions, I think the shutters come down and they think, I'll just think about that later on in life. I'll kick that can down the road. I'll think about it when I've got more earning power or I have more spare cash to be able to put some money away. But it's vitally important that you kind of take an interest in it like you would any other part of your finances. And I think there's that real sort of bury your head in the sand mentality when it comes to pensions. I think people need to find out what they're invested in, find out how much of their wage is going into their pension, how much they're going to need for a comfortable retirement. And one key bit of advice for me, Georgie, is just start as young as you can. Even if you don't think that you have that spare cash, largely you will put in a percentage of your salary, your employer is likely to match it, and it's much better than having a short-term, completely different thing. But if you think about savings, and we've spoken on this podcast quite a lot recently about just how low savings rates are, for example, you'd be much better off if you can to take that extra bit of cash and put it into your pension to try and get a better retirement. I mean, obviously, it's still important to have an emergency fund for other things, but it just feels like, even though there's more talk about pensions, it still feels like people are quite in the dark, and this research really highlights that.
Yes, there's an ignorance to it, and there's a... I'll deal with that later. But there's also an issue of, there are so many things that are competing for that pound in our pocket. We talk about, like you mentioned there, say having that buffer of savings. Okay, should I put it there? What about if I want to buy a house? What about if I want to send the kids to school? And all these things build up, these competing things for our money, that you think, oh, pension comes just so far down the line. But actually, you're right in pointing out just a little bit, little and often, can make such a huge amount of difference. I'm curious, I don't want to bang on too much about the women issue, but I am rather surprised that such a large proportion of women over men don't understand where their money is going. And, Micah Curry's been speaking to This Is Money about it. She's investment director at Fidelity International, saying that financial inequality at retirement is one of the greatest challenges facing women today. We live longer, we earn less, and we're more likely to take career breaks to raise children or care for elderly relatives, making it increasingly more difficult to close the gender pension gap of almost 11%.
Yeah, and you're right to point that out, Georgie, that this part of the research actually shows that women are far less engaged in their pensions than men are. And, you know, there is a likelihood that there'll be more of a gap in earnings, as in they might, women are more likely to take time off for childcare, for example. That couple of years away from perhaps saving into their pension, you know, might have a big impact. And I guess
that doesn't explain the lack of knowledge that predominantly women have. Is it the way that we're answering questions, and perhaps we do have more knowledge, we're just not quite so confident in saying we do? Or is it genuinely women? Because we see this in investment research, and I appreciate I'm asking you a question that's incredibly difficult to answer, because how would you know the answer to this? But it's something that we need to address. Is financial education in schools something that we could do better?
Definitely, not just in schools, I think in workplaces as well. So, you know, when you start in a new role, for example, I think that finding out about your pension and how your pension works, what you're invested in, you know, what percentage of your salary will be matched, how that could stack over time, and how much that might leave you with a pot at the end. All those sort of things should be sort of told, you know, perhaps at least when you pass your probation in a new role, and how to, you know, build up a pot of pensions cash. And I feel like actually quite a lot of that is missing. I feel like there is a bit of a kind of workplace knowledge gap when it comes to talking about things like pensions. And if you don't understand what this money is, where it's going, you should ask your employer. They should be able to, you should never be afraid to ask. You know, this is your money. Your money is going somewhere. And if you don't know where that money is going, you know, you should find out. And your employer should be able to give you a lot of information about how your pension works. They might even be able to put you onto an expert or someone within the business who can explain it, you know, in quite a lot of detail. What happens is a lot of people, you know, have that money funneled off for their retirement. Quite often people don't touch the contributions, they don't up the contributions, which can have, even just not adding an extra percent on over a few years, can put on thousands on your retirement. People just kind of leave it alone. Most people are invested completely in their default pension fund, which is, you know, usually quite medium risk. Whereas if you're quite young, let's say you're in your mid-20s or in your 30s, and you're kind of building a pot for retirement in 30, 40 years time, you can probably take a little bit more risk and maybe not just opt for that default fund, or at least mix it up a little bit and not have it just all in a default fund. But I think that people, you know, on the whole, just don't look into it, or they do look into it, but not until later life. And again, I can kind of understand it. And there's a great quote in this research that I think really sort of underpins what I'm talking about here. It said, Sarah Coles from Hargreaves, she said, "It's not your fault if pensions remain a bit of a mystery. Nobody taught you the basics. You were just supposed to pick it up through some kind of weird pension osmosis." Isn't that true? I mean, you kind of, I think you start a role and you just do not think about that pension. And you know, the other thing I would say that I think people sometimes get a little bit sort of confused about, and it can get quite confusing, and this is where this pensions dashboard is meant to be coming into play, is that, you know, we're in a time now where a lot of people perhaps aren't loyal to the same employer. They don't stay in the same job for decades and decades. Yeah, some people do, but a lot of people move around jobs, and then your pension, you kind of started building up a pot, and then you start a new job and you start from scratch again. And all these pension pots are just sort of dotted all around the place. And it gets a bit confusing as to whether you should merge them all or how to play it. And I think actually there needs to be a bit more of a push towards that. There must be people who were in their 30s, 40s, perhaps had half a dozen jobs, just got pension pots just dotted around doing nothing, getting eroded away by fees. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we could be doing to try and make sure that we're going to have a better retirement. I mean, we're going to talk about state pension in a minute. Who knows what state pension is going to look like in 30 years' time, for example. It scares
whether
me.
We'll even get one at all, you and I, when we retire, Lee.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't want to start throwing, like, you know, scary rumours out there. But it is one of those things where I think personally your own personal pension pot I would just be trying to attack it as much as possible. And look, as you pointed out earlier, Georgie, people have all sorts of different circumstances, all kinds of different savings goals, short-term savings goals, long-term savings goals. I just think that you know, your pension is such a fantastic way to save money. And spending a couple of hours on a wet Tuesday afternoon fiddling around with some pensions calculators to figure out how much extra you might get in retirement if you, for example, paid in an extra percent and your employer paid in an extra percent, or perhaps looking at some other investment options, whether it's you want to put a bit of your pension pot into some green investments, for example, or you want to go into some funds that are riskier, or you want to put it into some funds that are currently basically invested in the US. You know, we've seen this year US stock market's gone through the roof. You know, it's good to have a balance of all these kind of things in your fund. If you don't feel confident enough to do it, you know, you can always speak to a financial advisor, and you can also, again, just try and get some help from your employer, because they should be able to tell you what you're invested in and help you out for a richer retirement.
I think most people, if they do know that it's invested, I think a lot of people will just think, do you know what? Because I'm listening to you there, Lee, and I'm thinking, if I wasn't me and a personal finance journalist, then I'd probably be like, la, 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 don't really care right now. But then you ask someone, do you care about sustainability or the way that a company treats its employees or pollution or anything like that? And I like the fact that you mentioned green, because I wasn't really that engaged about where my investments. I thought, well, I'm investing or I'm in my pension, but all right. And then actually it was weirdly coronavirus, that time in my home when I had to kind of sit down and think about my future and where my money's going, because it matters to me where my money goes. And I changed a lot of my investments to be much more sustainable, much more green, because these are the things I care about. So if you genuinely care about those things, take a look at where you're spending your money, because your money makes a huge amount of difference. But Lee, you mentioned there about the triple lock. I want to talk about this because this has been making headlines. I understand I'm still in Spain, but from what I'm reading in Spain, it's been making a few headlines. A bit of a rift at the top of government, the Chancellor saying, look, this is pretty unsustainable. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, saying, well, you know, we need to keep it. It was an election promise to maintain it. But triple lock being a guarantee that the state pension will, of course, rise with the highest of inflation, average earnings growth, or 2.5%. However, there's a bit of an issue with furlough and increasing wages, meaning that the predictions are in 2021, wage growth could go up by 18%. Am I right here, Lee? And therefore, this state pension triple lock will be guaranteed the 18%, yeah? And I think it was last year they got over 4% rise. Not suggesting here, by the way, before anyone has a go, that I'm sort of penny pinching from people who are into retirement and taking their pension, right? I just want to point that out. I'm just saying the stats here. I'm saying the stats.
No, you're totally right, Georgie, because actually when I first read that stat, I thought, wow, that's not right. And you actually questioned me before the podcast. Is this 18% figure correct? But that is the forecast, you know, because we're looking at wages shrinking this year and then next year having a big bounce back. And then having an 18% rise in state pension would just be completely unheard of. Currently, the full new state pension is £175.20 a week. In April, we saw 4% rise because it was linked to wage growth then. 18% is a fifth, and you know, it's going to be quite a big boost if that happens. And actually, that could end up being a bit of a nightmare for government, you know, perhaps looking like they're treating pensioners like really well. It's obviously a big election winner, that triple lock. You know, it's very popular. It's a vote winner, and it goes right to Tory values. But, you know, this is a circumstance in which you can easily see why this is giving the government a headache, because, you know, 18% next year seems crazy. And perhaps the triple lock is going to need some sort of ceiling on it. As in, growth of 2.5% up to a maximum cap. I mean, that would probably be the sensible choice. But what a lot of pensioners will say, or people nearing retirement, is that state pension isn't generous enough in this country, and that, you know, other countries in Europe have better state pension amounts than Britain does. You know, that's an argument for another day. And they will say that an 18% rise is more than justified. but it's kind of the younger generations that be standing.
It's hard to justify when you, yeah, exactly.
Exactly, to justify when you know people are losing their jobs and there's going to be all sorts of economic strife potentially in the next few years. So what I find it hard to believe that the Chancellor and the Prime Minister are real loggerheads at this. I can't imagine this has been sitting around a table, throwing things around, getting angry. I mean, Rishi Sunak has kind of been one of the winners, I would argue, of the coronavirus in terms of politicians. He's come off the back of this popular eat out to help out deal where people are literally just calling it sort of Rishi's deal. It's just been shorthand to Rishi picking up the bill. And I think that it would be difficult to imagine that they're having big arguments about this because in my mind, there are solutions to this. And I think largely, I think the older population would understand some of the scenarios that could unfold. So in the story that our pensions reporter, Tanya Jeffries, has done, she's looked at the four options that are on the table. Essentially, the four things that could happen. The first one is just to keep the triple lock in place. And actually, perhaps wage growth next year won't be as high as what's anticipated, and perhaps it won't be as bad as all that. You know, this is something that was in the core of the both the Conservative and the Labour manifesto in the budget. But it could, as I mentioned there, be a bit of a political nightmare. Allowing that going to go up 18% more so than actually just changing the triple lock. So that's where the crux of the issue comes. The next part is to move to a double lock. So dropping the 2.5% part of the guarantee. This was an idea floated by a think tank earlier in the year, and it said it would save £20 billion over the next 5 years. At that time, growth in wages and prices were expected to be lower. And actually, this doesn't really solve the issue because it's the wages element of the triple lock that looks like it's going to be the problem. So the other two options are the ones that I would suggest look most likely to happen. Firstly, is to suspend the earnings element for a year. So that would mean next year that the triple lock, it would still mean that state pension went up 2.5%. But the earnings element would be stripped out. So it wouldn't be linked to earnings growth whatsoever. Or the other option, which has been floated by Aegon, a pension firm, is to introduce a two-year average for wages. So instead of saying, you know, whatever the wage growth would be between, you know, April this year and April next year, it will be more of an overriding look over the last couple of years, which would factor in the dip from this year and the potential rise for next year. And that might be a fairer way of doing it. But all these options I'm sure are currently being discussed. It's a very hard thing to get the balance right. As I mentioned earlier, this was an election promise not so long ago. I know the general election feels like a long time ago and all of that, all those promises, honestly, it all feels like a complete lifetime ago. But the option there, that last option to introduce the two-year average for wages, actually at a push and with a little bit of creative spin makes it sound like the Prime Minister could still say he'd maintain the triple lock even throughout this coronavirus crisis. So it's almost like a way of styling his way out of it to say, hey, you know, the triple lock has still been there, it's just been slightly adapted. So they're all the things that are on the table, Georgie.
I know, I just think, just say we're going to freeze it from last year, so just have the still a big rise from last year.
That's a potential option, Georgie. Yeah, why wouldn't that be an option?
Just say we're not getting rid of it, but because of this quirk in the system, just say look, we'll just keep it as it was last year, which is above 2.5% and above inflation. But there you go, who knows. One group of people who could be a little bit richer, your teenager, to the tune of £50,000. Those turning 18 now will be the first to get their hands on Child Trust Fund cash that was given to them when they were born. Now, the tax-free funds were launched in 2005, if you remember, by the then Chancellor Gordon Brown to try and encourage families to save for their kids' futures. So just briefly, Lee, tell us a bit more about this, how they work, what Child Trust Funds were, why they were brought in.
Georgie, first, before I start on this, I've got to say this is the first personal finance story that's ever made me feel a bit old. As in, when I started, Child Trust Funds were kind of in full flow. There was this whole campaign about being able to move them over to junior ISAs. It all feels like, wow, this is the first time I've actually gone from like start to finish of a story over the course of a decade. So yes, that has made me feel quite old. Now, child trust funds, they were launched in 2005 by Gordon Brown as a way to encourage families to save for their children's future. So you would get a voucher, 250 quid or 500 quid if you class as a low income household. This went on for children that were born from the 1st of September 2002 to January 2nd, 2011. So kids were given these vouchers for the best part of a decade, and then you would receive, your child would receive a second voucher age 7. This would help sort of grow the pot, and parents could choose to keep putting money into it until they turn 18, in which point they can choose what they do with the cash. Now, next week, we'll see the first tranche of those children come into adulthood, they turn 18. And could be set to see some chunky little windfalls. Now, if you've been really lucky and your parents or grandparents or guardians have, you know, added contributions to these products, you could be sitting on 50 grand plus, depending on if you had the money put in a cash account or a investing account. Actually, some figures crunch show that half kids will have a pot of about 5 grand, and there's a quarter of kids that have got 20 grand plus. Again, that all depends on how you're invested. 700,000 children a year will now, from this point onwards, have child trust funds that mature, around about 55,000 new adults a month. If your parent did nothing with the money, if you or the government just paid it in, because there's actually a big number of accounts in which the parents or guardians never got involved in, and government just put the money into an account, added the second voucher, and nothing's happened to it. If you fall into that category, if it was in a cash account, 668 quid, if it had been invested, you're looking at more like 1,200 quid. So it shows you the power of having the money invested over the long term. And essentially, this could be interesting, Georgie. This could be quite good timing for kids to get their money. In a way, it could be good timing. In a way, it could be poor timing, because there might be some children tempted. Well, I say children, new adults that would be tempted to just take that money and run, take that money out, get it. You know, with everything going on, you know, the strife, economic strife, as I mentioned earlier, that's going on, they might be tempted just to get it and spend it and think, or at least do something with the money that you might not want them to do. And that's always the danger of these types of products. And when they mature, it's like junior ISA, when your child can then has the legal access to the money and what they do with it. But actually, there was some interesting research that suggested that 80% would go on to continue saving or continue investing, which I think is quite, you know, we'd love to see that, because that was the whole idea. And actually, what I would suggest to parents or grandparents whose children or grandchildren are going to fall into this category is to sit them down, explain how the child trust fund worked, explain, especially if they're invested, how things like compounding work and how investing for the long term can work. It's a really good excuse to actually sit down with your child and tell them the benefits of investing and saving and what and for the future. And actually, we were talking about pensions earlier on in the show. Again, it's that kind of thing that might stick with them as they go into the workplace and going, oh, a pension. Well, I had this child trust fund over 18 years and I saw how that fund built up. Maybe I could do the same now I'm a responsible working adult to do the same thing. I'd love it if that had happened. I'd love it if people would sit down and talk to their kids about cash. But, you know, it's one of those things that it might not necessarily happen. But kids now, they have a choice, Georgie. These new adults with their savings pots, they can move it into a cash ISA. You want to keep that tax-free element because CTS are tax-free. So you move it into an adult cash ISA. The best easy access rate at the moment is just 0.9%. But still, if you want to continue adding to that pot, it's not a bad idea. You could move it into a stocks and shares ISA, especially if you are someone that's seeing the benefit, the power of investing, and you want to keep building that pot up for the long term. You know, kids that have got pots of 20, 50 grand, I mean, that's a great leg up to then start you know, starting point of investing, you might want to withdraw some of it and save some of it. Perhaps you want to spend it on some driving lessons, or perhaps you want to put it towards your university costs if you're about to go to university. Perhaps it will be a real sort of shot in the arm having that money to do that with. Or if you think that actually perhaps within the next 5 years, maybe 8 years, something like that, that you might want to use it for a house deposit, you might want to have a look at the lifetime ISA route and start saving some cash into that and get the government bonus. Wouldn't be a bad option, but only do that if you are adamant that you're going to use this pot for a future house. And the other thing I would say, as I mentioned there, 4.5 million of these accounts were opened by parents or guardians, but around about 1.5 million, 1.8 million, something like that, the government just put the money into an account because the parents didn't open it. What that means is actually there's quite a lot of lost and dormant accounts, and the prediction, the estimates are, there's £2.2 billion in a million accounts that's just never been touched and nothing's been done with. So what you'll need to do, the government website has actually launched a pretty simple online tool. So if you're turning 18 and you've got no idea where this money might be, you should be able to track it down just using your name, your date of birth, and your national insurance number. And some of these accounts have basically swap providers as well. So it will be handy to know if you do what provider you have. But for example, One Family is one of the financial organisations that holds a lot of cash because it took over child trust funds belonging to all sorts of companies, like Abbey National, Alliance and Leicester, Asda, Barclays. They took a lot of this money over, these CTFs. And I remember what happened was at the start of the decade, there was a big campaign when child trust funds were axed, and we knew that the axe was coming. There was a big campaign for people to be able to move this cash over to junior ISAs instead. And the argument was, especially in these cash versions, the market just shrank. Providers didn't need to be competitive because they weren't after your cash anymore. They just had it. And there was going to be no kind of competition in there. And junior ISAs launched, and the rates were far better than they were on CTFs. And actually, Money Mail did a big campaign to let this money go over to junior ISAs. And actually, that's what some people would have done. So some of that money would have just actually gone into a junior ISA, especially the cash versions. And again, there might be sizable amounts of money sitting in there as well. But it's massively interesting that how the government gave a leg up to children in that generation. Yeah. And what happens, A, if any of that money ends up going back into the economy, and B, if it actually does what it was intended to do and get children in the savings habit and understand what it means to save and invest money, which would be great if that is what happens with these CTFs.
We shall see. Lee, but one thing they shouldn't do, I would suggest, is, well, I probably don't think you could get a private jet for £50,000, but maybe you can. You've been taking a look at the cost of private jets. As I said before, don't say we don't cover it all here. Because, of course, I mean, the added bonus, I suppose, is people don't really want to go to airports, coronavirus and all the like. Are they really, really getting private jets? Apparently one specialist company seeing a surge in bookings and inquiries. Is this just not an overactive PR department saying that actually, no, those are people who have been getting in contact with us, really?
Well, Georgie, I approached them, so I hope not, because I asked the questions. They didn't approach me. This was a story that I was kind of interested in because I heard a kind of story earlier in the year. This was before coronavirus, in which on Facebook, a group, basically their children are at a private school, and they were going on a ski trip, and they looked up flights, commercial flights, budget airline, to go to whatever destination they were going to go to, and it was expensive. So they looked at chartering a private plane and dividing the cost between 12 or 16 people, or however money it was, wasn't that different. And that stuck in my mind. I thought, well, hold on a minute, that's quite cool. You might be able to charter your own plane, depending on what time of year it is and the destination, for, you know, not too far off from a commercial flight. And the benefit of going on a private jet, not that I've ever been on one or ever considered going on one, at the moment, is basically what Air Partner, the company that I spoke to, was talking about, is safety, convenience and flexibility. Now, the safety element of this is, of course, if you get a private flight, you go through your own terminal, you don't need to kind of mix with too many people around the airport. you know, all the things like baggage, going through those baggage, you know, metal detectors, scanners, all that kind of stuff. You know, you can kind of dodge that with private jets. And also some of these private jets operate from far smaller airports, although the real small ones you have to pay a little bit more money for. Flexibility is key as well. And I've argued this in the last few months. I think the way we book holidays and book travel is going to be so different in the next 5 years, in the fact that I think we're going to see extreme last minute booking is what I think. So we've seen at the moment, you know, all these quarantine rules come in seamlessly within 48 hours and makes it quite complicated to book somewhere. And I think what a lot of people, again, speaking to people I know, they're booking a week off work and then waiting until basically the day before to see if what's on the quarantine list, what's not on the quarantine list, booking something and going, rather than, you know, gambling on something long-term that might or might not be on the list. So a private flight, you might be able to get something pretty quick, or you might be able to say, actually, no, I don't want to fly to Croatia now as we had planned, because it's now in quarantine. I want to fly to Portugal instead because it's not in quarantine. And, you know, it might be the same price, it might be slightly different, but there's that kind of more flexibility than rather than booking a rigid slot with a commercial airline. But, Georgie, it comes at a cost, of course, and this is the real crux of the story. I wanted to know...
this is what we want to know, Lee. Come on,
how much does it cost to get a private jet? Now, we're talking about here European destinations. I think if you're looking anywhere out of that, it's going to be a lot of money. And what they told me, right, is that there's been a 321% increase in flight bookings in June, right, from previous years. And I thought this industry would be decimated because I thought a lot of it would be business travel. And of course, it is largely business travel. But at the moment, business travel's gone right down. And it's a lot of people using it for the first time for leisure flights. And some of the popular places, most popular places in the last couple of months have been Nice, Faro and Mykonos. So France, Portugal and Greece. And before that, Ibiza, before Spain became in the travel zone, Ibiza was hugely popular. So how much does it cost? I'll get there now. I'll talk about Italy, I think. I won't go through all of them. But a party of four flying from Luton or Stansted on a private jet, it'd be £12,300 to fly to Pisa, right? So that works out about £4,000 each, one way. Now, that sounds pretty pricey, doesn't it? It sounds quite a lot of money. I don't think many people would have the funds to go, ooh, £4,000 each, let's do this. But what I wanted to know and what I tried to establish in this story was, what is the plumb point? As in, what's the ideal number of people to have on the flight to split the costs to make it potentially a little bit more reasonable? So if you move to a party of 12 flying to Italy, flying to Pisa, it would be £19,600, which works out at £1,600 each. A bit more palatable. It's still expensive when you consider you can get flights to Italy, you know, sometimes. I think I had flights to Pisa booked earlier in the year for £50 return. So it's a little bit different. But this is a different kind of experience, isn't it, Georgie? And actually, at first, I looked at those figures and thought, oh, that is a lot of money. And it doesn't include everything that you could possibly think it would include: taxes, air passenger duty, insurance, catering, and the operational cost for flying to a certain airport. But then I started thinking, well, there's quite a lot of people that have had big refunds potentially for holidays who might go, do you know what, let's just treat ourselves to a private flight, you know, dodge those airport crowds, and this is a way to get away. For a lot of people, they'll simply hear that cost and go, cool, how much? Yeah, I'm not paying that much for to fly abroad. I'm looking at the weather this week in England. It's been rubbish around here. It's been windy, it's been rainy, it's been horrible. Is it worth paying that premium to get a private flight somewhere rather than paying for potentially an overpriced camping slot somewhere in Devon to be in some gale force winds, feeling miserable, thinking, cool, I wish I was either at home or I'd got a private jet to Portugal and be on the Algarve right now. You know, these are all things, it depends on your financial circumstances. And, you know, what I think this piece shows is that, yes, of course it's expensive to charter a private plane. Of course it's expensive. I'm not arguing that it's not. But the fact that more ordinary people, I say ordinary in sort of, you know, inverted commas, are booking flights this way suggests to me that some people have been willing to splash the cash on private flights. Like back in the day, people might have been willing to splash the cash on taking Concorde, for example. You know, unfortunately, we can't fly Concorde anymore. And that was really expensive. But for a blowout trip, perhaps anniversary, birthday, that kind of thing, you might be tempted.
You might be. And I think the point as well is that it's not as expensive. It's expensive, but as you might think when you look at all the kind of popular music videos and all that sort of thing. I sound really old now when I say that.
I do know, I do know what you mean, though. Yeah, but and actually,
does it come with champagne and all that? Well, like, I mean, I'd expect the works, not just a private jet. I'd want the works.
It says catering. It does say catering involved. So whether that's champagne or not, I'm not sure, but I reckon it might be.
It better be.
You can actually have the option as well not to have any cabin crew if you want to stay extra safe. So, you know, as in you don't want the risk of someone else being on the flight that potentially might or might not have coronavirus. So you can actually go on without. But if you do have cabin crew, I'm sure they'd keep you topped up with your drinks, Georgie. I'm pretty certain. And the other thought I had about this was I might be tempted to fly one way using a private jet and then just budget it home. You know, just get an EasyJet or a Ryanair at home. Like, you know, you've had two extremes then. And then you can could have decided, was it worth the money or not?
I wonder if it's the best to have the nice flight home to give yourself something to look forward to so you don't feel quite so miserable about going back. But that's, you know, neither here nor there. No speedy boarding passes needed here and plenty of leg room. Lee, before I let you go, you've, for your latest consumer trends column, looking at something called hard seltzer, which on first reflection, you think it's something for a super duper hangover, but actually it's not. On the contrary, Lee, it could give you one. It is alcoholic water. I don't know what to do with this, Lee. I mean, obviously you drink it, but what is the point of that? To me, this screams that you have a problem if you need to drink alcoholic water. I mean, well, apparently, like the New York Times is saying, yeah, this is the drink of the summer. I mean, you have to put something with it, no? So then it's like alcoholic Fanta or alcoholic lemonade, no?
No, that's not what it is, Georgie. So basically, I'm looking at this for my consumer trends column that goes out every Saturday. So this is the one that's going to be published this weekend. And the one about private flights was last weekend. So I do cover it all on this consumer trends column. Hard seltzers, Simon Lambert, editor, had asked me earlier in the year to have a look at this. And I finally got around to it now after I got a message from a friend who is a real lager swilling kind of character. He's not interested in anything else other than ale or lagers. And he was telling me, when are you doing a piece about hard seltzers? And I thought, oh, hold on a minute, if he's buying into it and drinking them, let's have a look. So yes, it's just alcoholic fizzy water, Georgie. And the benefits of it, or what's being pushed, is the fact that it's got fewer than 100 calories in it. And it's just essentially sparkling water, a little bit of alcohol, and some flavorings. Now these things aren't that strong. They're 4 to 5%
flavor of what?
Well, it depends. I've tried six this week. I've tried six various brands. There's one launched by BrewDog. There's one called White Claw, which is massive out in America. There's an independent one called Dirty that I tried, and I tried three different flavored versions from Aldi that are doing their own one called Nordic Wolf, which is half the price of the others. They've all got various flavourings. I've tried a lemon one, I've had cherry and cranberry, I've had blackcurrant, I've had mango and peach.
So it's not alcoholic water, it's alcoholic cranberry juice, or it's alcoholic lemonade.
Well, at its heart, it's probably, you know, the main ingredient is carbonated water, and that's where the name hard seltzer comes from, because basically in America, seltzer is carbonated water. And sales of it out in America have gone through the roof. I mean, it has become one of the most popular alcoholic beverages in the last couple of years from seamlessly nothing. It has just rocketed. I think it's strange ground to be treading, as in the fact that it's kind of targeting younger people that are into sort of like clean living and perhaps more health conscious. But I think it's very difficult to bill an alcoholic beverage as being anything like health conscious. You know, it's got alcohol in it. You know, that's the thing. It's kind of clean, it's crisp, it's, you know, doesn't perhaps have all the sugars that some alcoholic beverages have, or the calories and all that kind of stuff. But to me, I've tried these and it just tastes like other beverages that I've tasted pre-mixed in a can. It doesn't really do anything for me, if I'm being quite frank. But it's meant to be the next big thing. you can now buy these in Sainsbury's and Tesco. I've seen all these different brands there. It's been pushed quite heavily. Currently, globally, it's already grown in the last few years to a $4.5 billion business, most of that coming from America, but they forecast in 7 years it's going to be more like $15 billion. So it's a massive drinks trend. It's something that is kind of slowly creeping in here. I personally think that the term hard seltzer isn't right for the UK market, as in, like you say, that makes me think, like everyone says, it sounds like some sort of like hangover cure, which is something that doesn't exist anyway. Or it sounds like something that you might take if you've got indigestion. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't associate that with a tasty alcoholic beverage. They would have been much better calling it like a hard soda or something like that, where people would go, okay, yeah, I get that more.
I think it's importantly, what's in a name? To me, the way you've described this, being low-calorie, alcoholic water, sort of targeted, and you know, I am a woman here speaking, maybe a sort of more health-conscious people, health-conscious alcoholic, okay, but you know what I mean? Hard seltzer or Nordic Wolf, to me, just scream like those energy drinks, and not really something you'd take. You want something like Spring... something.
It's interesting to say that, actually, because the Nordic Wolf ones, out of all the ones I tried, actually did taste more like an energy drink. It was a bit, I wasn't a big fan of those ones, whereas the Brewdog one, which was called Clean and Press, and the White Claw, which is the big one out of America, actually tasted much sort of like I imagined. It was like soda water with a hint of flavouring in it. And actually, again, I talked about, you know, the dangers a little bit. It doesn't really taste like alcohol, and that's, again, for me, a bit of a dangerous sort of territory, I think, because these are as strong as beers, Georgie. I mean, I was drinking, I had three last night, and I thought, hold on a minute, you know, I thought I was just drinking some fizzy water, and then I was feeling it a little bit. And the other argument is, Georgie, it's, for me, it's like another sort of lazy consumerism thing, right? Is in, yes, if you're going to a party, not that we can go to many parties at the moment, or you're going to the beach or whatever, yeah, maybe it's easier just to take some cans of these drinks, right? And that's where the big market's been in America, like, you know, to think like universities and that kind of stuff. But, you know, if you're at home and you like that kind of thing, surely just some sparkling water and like a nice little squeeze of lime and a little dash of vodka, it's just the same thing, isn't it? I mean, it's no different, and it's healthier. You know, I say healthy, again, it's got vodka in it, but you know what I mean? It's like, you know exactly what's going into that drink. So it's one of those things. You have to read the story this week to get my full review on it. I like to try and keep my finger on the pulse of these kind of these trends, whether it's about alcohol or private flights. And I find it, I get immersed in it. I get quite interested.
I love the idea of you last night, just for the sake of the podcast, for the sake of this article, getting smashed nicely.
Georgie,
for our benefit.
I actually picked up my child from nursery yesterday, and I was like, I should really bring her home because she's going to be hungry. She's going to want dinner. And I said, do you want to go to the shop? And she said, yeah. And I drove 15 minutes to go to the Aldi just so I could get these Nordic Wolves in to try it for the column. So don't say I don't go out there and bust the gut to get these things done.
And employ your family in the process. That's all for this week. You can keep up to date with the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, anything consumer related as well that Lee can look into for his trends column, Lee?
Yeah, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. And you can also find us in the podcast channel and comment on the bottom of this article as well.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. The This Is Money podcast is brought to you with Charles Stanley Direct. Open an account today and start saving for your future. Investment involves risk.